Okay, I have a long list. Carl Cannon, you're up first. And Graham Wood, you did not raise your hand, but you just finished a book on ISIS, and so I'm going to call on you. Carl, you're up first, and then Graham, and then I have others.
For Professor Stern, but either one of you, or both, you said something that interested me. I think you said 40% of the Americans arrested for terrorism were Muslim converts, of the people arrested for. And I guess my question is, are they people who are attracted typically to Islam and then for tactical reasons are funneled into terrorism as cannon fodder because they're expendable and naive, or are they attracted to the violence and Islam is incidental to it?
Can I?
Yeah.
I will only tell you the latest case study that I have been working on. The story itself will answer almost all of your questions. There is no one story, like almost every one, single one of them, all of the above and even a different thing. For years in North Carolina, I have been working to improve homegrown terrorism and radicalization can only be solved if the Muslim community and the law enforcement learn how to work together. If the law enforcement will learn how to treat the Muslim community as part of the solution, not as part of the problem, and the Muslim community learn how to trust the law enforcement. So we have came a long way. We have built enough trust that now FBI and other local and federal law enforcement, when they see a case which is so absurd, which means when the somebody who's potentially radicalized is so young, so ridiculously naive and misled, they call us, and mostly me, to intervene and help. The latest story. And I have to be very careful not to reveal anything to violate the privacy of the family. A white kid, 12 years old, Catholic mother, LAPS, 12, and 30, and a LAPS Protestant father, never met a Muslim, never stepped into a mosque. I'm not going to psychoanalyze the kid's background and family structure, but at the age of 12, he starts watching YouTube videos of the ISIS propaganda. ISIS tweets 80,000 times a day, almost. Like there is a very sophisticated, in terms of what to do, in terms of, we have to really talk about the capability of this incredibly successful, as Dr. Stern said, messaging and branding, and trying to appeal certain kind of thrill seekers. At the age of 13, he converted to ISIS Islam without even meeting one Muslim ever in the United States. At the age of 14, he was talking to a Syrian jihadi ISIS, that's what he thought, but he was talking to FBI informant, making plans to go to Syria to fight in ISIS. And the FBI came and said, this is so bizarre. I mean, but if that boy was 18-year-old Pakistani-American or Arab-American or Turkish-American, they would have never come to us. They would send more informants to see how far he will go, and then he will. This was like many cases. We have 9 cases brought to us as a community, and we have 100% success rate. We intervened. The result is different. That this kid, after we said, you have to, I said, I'm not going to tell you not to go ISIS, but I am going to tell you if you are going to accept Islam, accept and reject it as is. So we conducted our basic information about mainstream Muslim theology. He's been to the mosques. It's so interesting. After 6 months of learning what Islam is in its all complexity, including the ISIS version of Islam, he said, I'm not interested. This is so boring. He didn't even want to remain as Muslim anymore. It is so bizarre and interesting. But almost 50% of the people going, I heard it's even higher, recent converts, and get into their conversion zeal, buy into this idea is West is at war with Islam, and the dignity and honor of Islam have been stabbed, and we have to go and defend our brothers and sisters in the Muslim world. That's their only selling message. And it's working because Muslim societies are in deep trouble, deep, 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 deep pain. And ISIS gives a very black and white, very reductionist, simple answer to all the miseries in the Muslim world. And some people who are recent converts attracted to this.
I've been talking at great length to a young man who had been at Columbia University, and he started a website He converted. It turned into essentially Inspire magazine, which is the magazine put out by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula that had the recipe, how to make a bomb in the kitchen of your mom, which the Boston Marathon bombers followed. He had read my book, Terror in the Name of God, when he was in prison, and he felt that I understood him, and he tried to get the prison authorities to have me come talk to him. Anyway, he's out of prison now. He actually started out with a very left-leaning ideology. And I mean, this is not common, I think, but people come from all kinds of ideologies. He was against globalization, and he still is. But he's now interested in getting involved in playing a role in counter-radicalization, which I think is great.
Graham Wood? Good. Graham, when does your book come out?
I've got a book that's coming out on ISIS that I hope will be worthy of Jessica's example later this year, so possibly as early as the fall. But thank you both for very stimulating comments. I've got questions for both of you. Jessica, I wonder if you might say some more about what you alluded to at the beginning of ISIS using some familiar tricks, things that you've seen before in the use of religious rhetoric for perhaps insincere ways. Because you mentioned a few tensions or contradictions within the way that ISIS operates. One of them, the difference between the instrumental use of slavery and the, I guess on the other extreme would be the inherent value of it or the divine command to practice slavery. The contradiction between the desire to build a state and the desire to bring about the apocalypse, which would presumably destroy all states. And then there are other contradictions that I think are also sometimes adduced, like the difference between the religious origin and the political origin of ISIS or of groups like it, or the difference between the lack of religious practice or even the sinfulness of fighters and their apparent religiousness now or claims to be religious. And what has struck me in some of the conversations that I've had with ISIS supporters is that they don't view any of these things as contradictions. They don't view any of them as undermining their religious sincerity or the religious nature of their organization. So I wonder if some of the conversation that we've had about, that we collectively have had about the religious nature of ISIS versus the non-religious nature of ISIS, if ISIS is willing to accept those contradictions and to admit that its fighters have had sinful pasts and have improved themselves to the point of being fighters in the name of God, that whether this conversation might not actually be one that's necessary to have at all. I've got a second question for Blue Devil Imam as well.
Go for it before you forget.
Okay. Well, I was first of all very interested in your comparison with the Reformation, and I wonder if you might say more about that.
Sure.
And also your eagerness not to essentialize Islam, not to say Islam is a religion of war, Islam is a religion of peace. The Reformation comparison is one that I'm curious about, in part because a lot of the Catholic polemics against Luther analogized him to Muslims.
Sure.
And said, look, he is proposing a kind of religion that is headless, that has no central authority. Mm-hmm. But while you seem to be unwilling to essentialize Islam, you seem to be very willing to essentialize Wahhabism, which, if you call it cancerous, violent, and so forth. So if we were to extend the analogy further, I think we would rightly be careful about essentializing Protestantism, say. So I wonder if you might speak about whether Wahhabism also has this capacity to have a peaceful Wahhabism, whether it can, rather than trying to eliminate it or oppose it inherently, we might see after a few hundred more years of Wahhabism, a nice Wahhabism that we could all live with.
Excellent questions. That's the hope.
Professor Stern.
I want to be clear. I didn't mean to imply that anybody's insincere. Any of the religious terrorists are insincere. I think that the reasons for the spread of this ideology have more to do with political and economic factors and cultural factors and a crisis in Muslim-majority states than with the religion per se. Mm-hmm. So I'm not questioning their sincerity, although clearly some of the locals who have escaped are saying, I joined this fighting force because they paid more than Nusra. Or we know that those who were fighting on the U.S. side during the surge were promised jobs in the Maliki regime and didn't get those jobs, became ripe for the picking for reasons of security, not necessarily because they buy into the ideology. So I think it's complicated. I think some are very sincere in their beliefs, but many who are there, who join, do so for other reasons. I mean, they are going after gamers, for example. You know, when we look at how they're able to attract young people, they have Call of Duty films. I mean, it's not, kids are joining for many, many different reasons, and ideology is just one of them.
Can I add to that question also? I have never seen, as an imam, way too many sinners come to my office, or I find out about them through law enforcement. I recently have been working with the police department with a group of pedophiles who have, in the name of religion, both in Christianity and Islam, raped so many boys and girls for over decades. And I was so appalled at the rationalization of this, like despicable, disgusting. I have never seen a sinner who hasn't rationalized his sin, either a domestic violent abuser husband, or a pedophile, or a terrorist. Therefore, I would give very little credit to people who rape, who burn people alive, who destroy innocent lives. What they say and the way they rationalize these apparent contradiction in their faith and not seeing them as sinner, in my mind, they have no credibility. Because sin by itself is forcing people to rationalize it. Otherwise, they will not repeat it. They will ask forgiveness for it. Therefore, I would not dismiss it, but I think this is a sinner rationalization going on, not anything authentic, not anything scholarly or intellectual is taking place. If we are going to see the peaceful Wahhabism, that's the hope. And I'm not, maybe in my... Do you want to know my third title? People, when people hear me speak, they say, are you really an imam? I say, yes. They say, no. There's a Southern Baptist preacher in you. Maybe my Southern Baptist zeal might have sounded like I'm essentializing Wahhabism. That's the hope. I'm not advocating wiping out the whole Wahhabism. I believe every evil theology in the healthy context, it sort of tames itself and domesticates itself and becomes a healthy community. If you look to Khawarij, the example that I gave in the first century of Islam, they became, over time, when the institutions defeated their violent elements and when the overall health of the society absorbed and digested them, and they became incredible intellectuals later on. The assassins are now the Ismaili community, a sect of Shia Islam, who were serial assassins and now one of the best and most organized intellectual, cultural, academic Muslim community. Aga Khan community, that's their sources. They evolved. Protestantism, if it wasn't through certain helpful historical, it could have turned into ISIS. It could have been a Christian ISIS. But thank God it didn't. But Wahhabism, unfortunately, got out of control. Wahhabism really became cancerous, and what's the term? It metastasized.
Imam, could you, in 25 words or less, not assume that everyone knows what Wahhabism is, and give a short definition of its roots. It's rooted in Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Just a short definition of Wahhabism.
It's a movement against. There are so many movements. When Muslim civilizations were collapsing, there were many answers by the Muslim scholars and movements. Why are we losing? Why are we collapsing? Why are we these people who a couple of hundred years ago in dark ages are now coming and taking our land and insulting us and breaking, stabbing our honor? The Wahhabi ideology's answer to this Muslim civilization collapses because we lost our religion, because we didn't keep the originality of our religion. We were perpetual sinners. We have to go back to the Salaf, the Prophet and the immediate companions of the Prophet, and everything else in between is questionable, if not rejectionable. We have to go back and understand and live according to the basically rejection of tradition. That's why it's reformist. It's incredibly reformist. It's rejecting 1,400 years of Muslim history, and it's saying we are going to go and implement the way the first 100-year Muslims lived, and we are going to that's why when you see the ISIS destroying those beautiful ancient artifacts, which was religiously protected by previous Muslims for generations, when you see them killing Yazidis and Iraqi Christians who were kept and protected and supported for many years, that's why they say, no, we have to go back and create a pure Muslim state. Yeah. That's the ideological zeal.
You know, I wanted to get that. That's very important. And if everyone saw Graham Wood's essay in The Atlantic over a year ago called What ISIS Really Wants, which is now becoming his book, Graham has a wonderful overview of all these different varieties.
The tone of anger and frustration that you see from about me with Wahhabism, part of my State Department de-radicalization program is all in East Africa now. After 9/11, all the Wahhabi missionary free literature, billions of dollars of toxic, pure hate literature used to come to the United States. It was flooding all of our prison system. After 9/11, thank God, Alhamdulillah, Baruch Hashem, it doesn't come here anymore. But now they are channeling all of it to East Africa, to Central Asia, to Southeast Asia. We have to do everything we can to at least, in the ideological ground, minimize their impact and destruction.
Okay, Graham, quickly.
Can I just very quickly ask you, you mentioned the Harajites as a previous example of
sure.
this. The early Wahhabis and the Harajites were basically defeated militarily.
Yes.
So it wasn't a matter of countering violent extremism through giving other forms of Islam, nurturing the other wolf. It was a matter of attacking that other wolf.
I respectfully disagree. They were militarily defeated, but the violent elements, those who are killing people, they were defeated militarily. But ideological poison was treated by the overall health of the Muslim institutions reacting to what they are claiming. Saying this is this kind of interpretation, literalist understanding, has no place in the Muslim tradition. You cannot confine Islam to the understanding of the first 100 years. Yes, you're absolutely right. Both assassins, Khawarij, and many others, like the Ibrahim Kushchu in Ottoman Empire, there are so many violent. They were defeated on the battleground, but it didn't end there. If you look, there is an incredible amount of cultural and the theological work done. Oceans of literature have been produced to undermine their ideological and theological.
Okay.
So I just feel the need to say that Saudi Arabia is at the cutting edge in counter-radicalization. Saudi Arabia, there's a letter that's in your paper, described in your paper from a senior member of the royal family. I think he's actually the Minister of Interior.
Your paper is the Washington Post?
Yeah.
Your paper. Kathleen's paper.
Really yeah. resentful that the president accused the Saudis of free riding. I mean, I don't think we need to rely on Saudi Arabia to help in this fight. They are a critical part of it. They are most threatened by ISIS. So I think it's important that we not demonize. I mean, ISIS presents a threat to the entire world. Saudi Arabia is number one beyond the region that is threatened. I just wanted to add that.
No, that's very helpful. No, let me jump in. I'm going to call on Mort Kondracki. I've got you on the others on the list. We're going to be taking a break in a minute, but Mort is up next. And then after Mort, Someone who's not raised their hand is Fred Barnes. And Fred, you had a wonderful question the other day before the conference for this panel, and if you won't repeat it, I will, if you remember our conversation.
What do you imply?
Right,
not right off, but then I'll ask it for you.
You're free to ask it for me.
Well, no, Fred's question quite simply was, okay, I get it, but why murder innocent people who have nothing to do with any of this? You work with them, you know them, and you go shoot them. That was simply your question. I mean, can somebody just quickly explain? These are innocent people working in San Bernardino. They didn't harm anybody. Yeah, in California. And Fred said to me, I can't wait for that panel, because he said, I understand some of this, but to go and just find these innocent people and shoot them. Can somebody please explain that in 25 words or less before Mort asks the same question?
Well, there is no rational explanation to that kind of barbarism. But I think if I have to give it a try, ISIS thrives on fame and publicity. They count retweets, they count likes, they thrive in that kind of, their recruitment effort to be able to sensationally, that's what terror, khivara in Arabic means, pumping fear into the hearts and minds of people, and they will do everything they can. They will do everything they can. Look, a good example would be, on their way to the Jerusalem, why the crusaders killed everybody, Christian, Jew, Muslim. My hometown is on the Syrian border, southeastern part of Turkey. It was one of the major paths of crusaders. They ate babies alive. Like the kind of cruelty, they sort of chop people into pieces and display their organs. Any organization thrives in pumping fear into the hearts and minds of people. There is no limit to human geniuses in that regard.
Okay, Mort Kondrak, you pull the mic over. Jessica, do you have anything to add to that? Push the button on.
So I asked Jessica this question at dinner the other night, and I'll ask you. Donald Trump says they hate us. A lot of them hate us. What percentage of the Muslims in the world hate us?
Who are they and who are us? I mean...
he's talking about the United States.
Right.
And
Mort is now speaking for Donald Trump.
Yes.
Go ahead.
First and only time. He's saying that around the world, Muslims hate us in general. How many? A lot of them. So what percentage of the world's 1.7 billion Muslims spend any time of their day hating America?
I don't know. I mean, anybody who says and gives the a precise percentage would be lying. But I know that very small. I know that very, very many people who are so angry with our policies, with our foreign policies, economic policies, as a result, they sit on a pile of anger and frustration. Even them, when they are death to America, with right hand, they are, with the left hand, they are saying, give me visa.
Yeah, right. are there any data on this?
No.
There are no good data on the subject. I mean, I've seen...
Mujahid, do you remember the Gallup who speaks on behalf of Muslim Islam?
Yeah.
Dalia Mujahid. Yeah. There were quite precise data there. I don't have the number.
2009, there was a Gallup. Hello, can you guys hear me? 2009, Gallup did a poll of 1 billion Muslims. Extensive. I think they spent 7 years, and then subsequently was written into a book by John Esposito and Dalia Mujahid, What Muslims Really Think. I think it's very telling, pardon me for this small interlude, but they said the two major grievances that of Muslims that they polled against America was, number one, the hypocrisy of U.S. foreign policy compared to U.S. values. So it wasn't just U.S. foreign policy, but it was the hypocrisy between U.S. foreign policy and values. The second thing, which was very fascinating, which for some strange reason people don't pick up on, which I think is really illuminating, was the disrespectful depiction of Islam and Muslims in U.S. media. When it came to overall thoughts about the United States, overwhelming majority of Muslims respected the United States for its freedoms, its values, its technology, it's also its education. It's a really good book. It was released in 2009.
Okay, so
book again.
What Muslims think?
What a billion Muslims really think, and it was based on the 2009 Gallup poll of quote 1 billion Muslims. I think they spent 7 years on that poll, and the book which analyzed it was written by John Esposito of Georgetown and Dalia Mogahed.
Okay, so the
Mort finish, and I'll get Tom. Mort finish.
So I suggested to Jessica that she write an op-ed piece.
Yes.
Because of what Trump has said, and because there is mass confusion in the United States about his assertion. What?
Say that on the mic.
I need to stop you right there because that's my column today.
Oh, it is. Okay. All right. What data did you cite?
I'm citing these two people right here.
Good for you. Okay. So my second question is then, you started to say, as opposed to hammering ISIS, that we've got to have a Marshall Plan, we've got to deal with Wahhabism. Have you laid out the agenda of what a smart U.S. president would do?
Well, I'm an educator. Like, every pony has a trick. My trick is education. All the outline, agenda, and plan is evolved in education. In the long term, there needs to be a large scale of education, both in the Muslim world as well as in the United States. But I am not a politician, I'm not a policymaker, not yet at least, when I get to that level. But there are so many incredible bright minds who are really putting out so many impressive plans. I highly encourage you to look at what ISPU has been doing, for example, in terms of specifically about de-radicalization. What can we do in the short run and in the long run?
On this point, Tom wanted to jump in on this point.
Jessica mentioned Dalia Mogahed.
Into the mic, Tom.
I'm speaking into the mic. Jessica mentioned Dalia Mogahed, who used to be with Gallup, and now she's with another organization, the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding. Is today March 15th?
Yes.
They have a poll that just came out that is just released today of American Muslims, only of American Muslims. Just very quickly, some of the key findings. Here's one that's interesting. Muslims are as likely as Protestants to have a strong American identity, 85% Muslims, 84% Protestants. They are also as likely as other Americans to identify strongly with their faith, 89% of Muslims, 84% of Jews, 95% Catholics and Protestants. But here's the most interesting one, I thought. The percentage of Muslims who are satisfied with the direction the country is going is almost double the level of optimism shown by Jews, the second most satisfied religious group. 63% of American Muslims are satisfied with the way the country is going versus 38% of Jews. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Muslims are the least likely faith group to be politically engaged. Only 60% of Muslims who reported they could legally vote were registered to do so, compared with at least 86% of Jews, Catholics, and Protestants. Now, there are a lot of other findings in here. It's the American, the ISPU American Muslim poll just released today.
Hmm. Let's see, I think Miranda Kennedy and then Knapp. So the mics are over there for the two of you. We're back in on it now. Thank you.
Yeah,
and then you're on the list, Sharon. Shannon, I got you. Not yet, but in a minute.
If Kathleen would stop laughing. If Kathleen would stop laughing, we could talk about ISIS some more. Yeah. I was just curious about Saudi Arabia I was going to ask both of you what you think we, the U.S., should do about Saudi Arabia, but I feel like I know now what you think we should do, that we should cooperate more. We should continue cooperating with Saudi Arabia. Is that right?
Let me do this. I meant to make this announcement. What I would like to do, we have such a long list, is write down that question, both of you. What I'm going to do is get a few people in the queue, and we'll add up the questions. Miranda's question, and then Nazareth. Let me get about three or four on, and we can answer them, and then we can keep moving that way. Because there's so many of you on the list. And then Knapp, follow her question up with a question. You're next.
Okay, well, I didn't finish.
Oh, well, I thought you were...
No, I was just making sure I understood her perspective, but it doesn't have to be a long one. I just was asking before. I'd like to know what you think we should do specifically about Saudi Arabia.
So, Jessica, I appreciated what you said about it's not your position to say who's the theologically correct position. And then Abdullah said that you thought that saying Islam is a religion of peace is overly simplistic, and it reminded me of this...
And not true,
okay. It reminded me of a debate 2 years ago at Faith Angle Forum. We had Elliot Abrams sitting where you are. Michael Gerson was somewhere down there. And they were debating whether it's appropriate for presidents to make the statement that Islam is a religion of peace. And so the issue for me is, I want the peaceful Muslims to win, right? What the Quran says is, you know, not important to me. What's important to me is that the peaceful Muslims win, meaning, you know, when that teenage Muslim is deciding, oh, do I like the radicals or do I like the peaceful? I want him to go with the peaceful ones, right? So for us non-Muslims, how do we encourage that? How do we help that happen? Because we really have a big interest in the peaceful ones winning, right?
These are actually two very good questions. So let's answer these and then we'll keep moving. First, Saudi Arabia and then Nab.
Please, you are more charitable in Saudi Arabia than I am.
Well, good, let's hear that. What are the geopolitical
mistakes? I get uncomfortable when we come up with univariate explanations for terrorism. So I was reacting out of discomfort. I think it's...
What was the word you used?
We are friends. Get rid of this discomfort.
What?
We're friends.
You are friends. But you can be comfortable.
And I also think it doesn't, I think we actually really need Saudi Arabia this is, as Bernie Haykel says, untamed Wahhabism. He doesn't say it's Wahhabism, he says it's untamed Wahhabism. As a woman, obviously, as a human being, I'm not remotely comfortable with Wahhabism, but I don't think it's helpful to demonize a country that we really need in this fight.
I don't disagree with you when you say we need Saudi Arabia in defeating this, but I think we have to cooperate with Saudi Arabia with very open eye and critical eye, and we have to exercise tough love. Their religious establishment is in the hands of untamed Wahhabism. Their religious establishment is in the hands of people who are pumping this ideology all over the world. And therefore, as we did with communism and other ideologies who we thought were not kosher, I think we should have the same kind of skepticism and filtering. Saudi Arabia beheads more people than ISIS every year. Women cannot drive. 9-year-old girls are allowed to marry because of a sickening, despicable ideology, which is the official religion. And I think, again, when we cooperate with a state, I think it should all be in harmony with our ethical moral values. It shouldn't be only just solving problems and fixing issues and turning a blind eye on their gross human rights violations. This is a consistent, I think, innate hypocrisy in our foreign policy if you can keep doing this. Plus, these guys are still pumping this bad ideology to all over the world. And part of our engagement with Saudi Arabia should be twisting their arms and making them stop. And to the your question in terms of politicians should be say, you know, if you say it a week after 9/11, trying to drop the temperature, I mean, that there is some wisdom there, especially if you're a Republican, if you understand American society is very vulnerable and there's a hate and uncontrolled hate could take place, violence could take place against Islam and Muslims. In that particular sense, it's somewhat understandable. But just to score political points, to be cheesy, to stick to these stereotypes and the sound bites, I think it's not very helpful. For peace-loving Christians supporting peace-loving Muslims, You know, one of the biggest influence on me after I came to the United States was reading Abraham Joshua Heschel. This man, what he did as a non-black for civil rights movement is incredible in American story. In the context of American civil rights struggles, he said something really profound. He said there are few people who are guilty. ISIS is guilty, this politician is guilty, etc. But as he says in that context again, all of us are responsible. We arrived to this point together, and we can only bounce back together. What peace-loving Jews, Christians, Hindus, and Muslims can do, feeling that sense of responsibility and fighting the fight, and not being a moderate, lazy person. The part of the problem is these crazies are so active, so hardworking, so determined. The forces who are trying to divide us, working day and night. There is one group in Lynchburg, Virginia. Every week they are sending me a literature that God will barbecue me in the hands of, in the dungeons of hell. Like every week, I admire the consistency, like hard work. Unbelievable that they never give up. I always respond saying, like, even if you want me to convert to your brand of Christianity, don't you think there's a marketing problem here? Like, you should be talking to me. But I admire the consistency. Most peace-loving Christians, like most peace-loving Muslims and Jews and Hindus, regretfully, they are moderate, peace-loving, but they are lazy, my friend. They are inactive. And they don't understand how their laziness, silence, and inactiveness empowering the fringe crazies in their communities. The problem is not these crazies and violent people. The problem is the choir that we preach. They understand they are peaceful, but they don't act. They don't pay. They are not motivated. They are not mobilized.
Kathleen Parker. Kathleen, and then Will Salatan, and Shannon, and Claire, and Mindy, and Jamie, and Andrew, and Daniel.
And, yes. If Michael Kathleen would just stop talking. This question is directed to Jessica, but I welcome your thoughts as well. So you spoke very early in your comments. You said that that you would call ISIS Islamic or Islamist, and that the president refuses to. You hear a lot of criticism about that from the right and the Republican Party about how that you can't fight an enemy that you won't name, or you can't deal with a problem that you can't identify. And I'm not sure that logic follows, but you are willing to call it, recognize that it is based on Islamic text, et cetera, to limited degrees, or selective degrees. So my question is, how important do you think it is to identify ISIS as motivated in part by the texts? I understand that the president can't, every time he mentions it, explain all the nuances, but he has just declined simply to, I think it's probably because he doesn't want to alienate good Muslims, you know, moderate Muslims who might otherwise be on board. But anyway, I welcome your thoughts on the naming aspect, and then if we were to be more open about it, if the president were to be more specific, would that help in any way other than political in this country? Mm. Would it help in our efforts to combat ISIS?
Okay, let's get Will on, and then we'll answer those two.
Kathleen, thanks for taking my first question, so I've got two more. Kathleen's question was exactly the first question I wanted to ask. And actually, just to follow up on it, I wanted to just press Abdullah on whether, you know, the Republican criticism of the violent extremism framework is that it's too vague. Do you think that that way of framing the issue actually impedes addressing the problem, or is that just cosmetic? Is that just an umbrella term, and within it, that they are doing an adequate job of confronting the specific problem?
Can you please define that Republican framework for me?
Oh, just what Kathleen was saying. The objection is that by talking about that, we won't name the problem. The Ted Cruz version, if you don't name the problem, you can't address it. Now, your criticism is much more complicated and specific, but it's on a similar point.
Sure.
Wahhabism, right? So do you think this violent extremism framework is just superficial, an umbrella term, and within it they're doing an adequate job of addressing the problem? Or do you think that that refusal to call it Islam is part of failing to address the specific problem of Wahhabism? And then if you want to, if you feel like talking about, I'm sure a bunch of us in this room would love to hear about your de-radicalization methods, and what kind of conversations do you have with these people? What's effective? that may be too long to deal with, but I'm just curious about it. And one thing that really struck me in your remarks is some of the language that you used here, and I don't know, haven't heard you before, despicable, disgusting, sickening, turns your stomach. This is, you know, is that something that you used for every audience? is that something that you do to make clear to non-Muslims that Muslims do object to this? Do you think that non-Muslims don't hear this enough from Muslims, particularly in this country?
So both of those questions are related, so let's stay on those two, and then we'll go to two more, Kathleen's and Will's. So Jessica, your comments on Kathleen's critique of the president.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why, and you understand why the president refuses to call this group Islamist, and why he uses CVE. I mean, Muslims interpret CVE as...
What is CVE?
Countering violent extremism rather than countering Islamist terrorism or Islamist violent extremism. Unfortunately, what it means is Muslims object to any CVE, many Muslims object to any kind of CVE now because it's a weaselly term for going after Muslim terrorists. I think it's important to call it by its name, not for TED Talk reasons, but why not? I don't know. I mean, everybody knows what we're talking about, so I don't know that it makes that big a difference politically. I think it's silly, frankly. I'm curious what you...
Well, thank you for giving voice to my frustration. This, what should we call this, feels like Hillary Clinton emails. What should we call this problem? What's the name and what's the word? It feels like Hillary Clinton emails over and over and over. You remember what Bernie Sanders said about them. Like, part of me says it's not important. Let's deal with the real issue. These people are calling on to each other to not to solve the problem or come up with a helpful term, but to basically stab at each other, score political points against each other, which is quite regrettable, which is another manifestation of the deep destructive polarization in our political life. Every issue is a point to attack my political opponent. Every issue, including this one, as if we name it this way or that way will make any difference instead of talking our substantial issues. But I think we should call it as is. It's a manifestation of Islam. It's an expression of Islam in the way that I said, has roots in ideology and theology, in Muslim cultures and histories, which are Western policies and foreign policies and economic policies have contributed, our invasions of those countries, Israeli-Palestinian conflict. These are contributing factors. In that sense, slice of it, it's an expression of Islam, but it's not the authentic expression of Islam.
So I should rewrite my lead to say both Donald Trump and Barack Obama are helping ISIS?
In some ways, yeah. I'm hoping not intentionally, but more Muslims should say, more Muslims should stop becoming naive, unhelpful, apologetic. More Muslims should stop this nonsense. This has nothing to do with Islam. I understand why Obama as a politician, as a non-Muslim, is not saying this, but more Muslims confidently say, yes, these people are Muslim and they claim to do everything they do in the name of Islam. It's an expression of Islam, which has its roots in Islamic history and Islamic texts. But it's evil, it's perverted, it's twisted. We should fight against it. I don't understand that Muslim undefensiveness. Very common. It has nothing to do with Islam, really.
Are you willing to go on TV and talk about this soon?
Sure.
I tell you why. Because
if I can ever get invited to Fox TV.
Well, because one of the first things we hear after San Bernardino is, where are the moderate Muslims who are condemning? Why are they so quiet? Why are they so intimidated? Where are they? And I'm going to say, well, call them my friend in Durham.
Here we are.
There
are so many of them.
There are.
There are so many of us. That's another question. Why, after 14 years, so much effort by the Muslim community in the United States, doing everything they can, almost at the expense of their own well-being, after 15 years, overwhelming majority of Americans are still saying, where are the moderate Muslims? This is a $1 million problem. Maybe as a question we should discuss. I think partially because Muslim community is working hard but not working smart, and they need your help, or the majority, and American society at large, they are so lazy, they don't want to diversify their sources of information. They are stick with whatever they know, and they don't go one extra mile to see if it's amazing. Like, most of the conversations about Islam and Muslims are happening in the absence of Islam and Muslims. Muslims are not in the room. They are not extended the microphone. This is an exceptional and admirable invitation, which I'm really grateful. I hope we are deserving that trust.
May I just say one more thing? So I understand that it's silly not to name it, that may as well name it. I get that. But would it help in any way to name Islam as the problem, an aspect of Islam as the problem?
I think it would.
You do?
I think it would. I think he should call it. He shouldn't be too... he should have the courage. Yeah, some Muslims might be defensive and angry, but he should also provide that complexity. Mm-hmm. And some Muslims, like me and Mujahid and others, by articulating why this is an expression of Islam, but an unacceptable, wrong expression, it should be defeated, it could help as well. I think it would.